You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll take a look at the stand-up comedy boom in the last few years and its influence. First, on November 23, 1965, UW Extension Chancellor Donald R. McNeil introduced a very special guest to a crowd of 3,000 people in the UW-Madison Stock Pavilion.
While no one person or one group can take credit for the full measure of these successes this past decade, one may well ask where we in America would be today without the man who honors us with his presence this afternoon. His career is well known. Born and raised in Atlanta, he studied at Pennsylvania, Harvard, and Boston universities. From Boston, he received his PhD degree in 1955. Holder of more than 20 honorary degrees, he is the author of several books: Stride Toward Freedom, The Measure of a Man, Strength to Love, and Why We Can't Wait. During his spectacular career, he has been jailed, threatened, cursed, and reviled on the one hand, praised, acclaimed, and honored on the other. Most men are accorded high honors at the twilight of their illustrious careers, and it is most significant that last year, at the age of 35, he received the Nobel Peace Prize. This can only mean that our honored guest has many years ahead of him to further the cause of civil rights. This can only mean that he shall continue during ensuing decades to hold high the torch of hope, as he did on that unforgettable day in Washington when he told the nation and the world, "I have a dream." Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you one of the leading citizens of America and of the world, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Tragically, Dr. King would be assassinated less than 3 years later. In the nearly hour-long speech at UW that day, Dr. King touched on several issues. Here's an excerpt where he addresses the unfair treatment of blacks by the legal and criminal justice systems, issues that remain today.
In the Lowndes County, Alabama jury acquittals of the indicted killers of the civil rights workers Jonathan Daniels and Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, the spotlight of concern of the civil rights movement has been focused anew upon the problem of segregated justice in the South. In a real sense, this problem is part and parcel of the age-old conflict between creeds and deeds, between the lofty ideals of justice and the lowly prejudicial practices couched in the administration of law. The reconciliation of this conflict between the ideals of substantive justice and the hard facts of prejudicial procedural justice constitutes the most compelling challenge constituting the civil rights movement today. The outcome of the Lowndes County, Alabama cases cogently suggests that the whole structure of Southern justice is contaminated with racism and corrupted by color consciousness. Indeed, it appears to be an edifice that needs drastic alterations and facelifting, refurbishing, and reformation in order to be salvaged. The Hayneville cases are by no means isolated incidents, but rather a part of the blighted pattern of segregated justice, a pattern which has led to the murders of at least 26 Negroes and white civil rights workers at the hands of racists in the last 5 years, in the stretch from 1960 to the present. Of all these incidents, only one of the murderous assailants was convicted and sentenced for his dastardly deed. In similar vein, Federal Bureau of Prison Statistics show that despite the fact that more than half of the convicted rapists are white, 87% of all the persons executed for rape between 1930 and 1963 were Negroes, convicted and sentenced by Southern courts. The double standard of justice is equally applicable to lesser crimes as well. And such is a brand of justice impinging upon the Negro. And this is what he faces in his day-to-day living. Once he is arrested, he knows the cards are stacked against him, for he has then to confront a world which is practically as totally prejudiced as it is totally white. The all-white complexion of Southern justice is graphically depicted by Attorney Charles Morgan. His betrayal is written up in the Southern Regional Council report entitled Southern Justice and Indictment. Attorney Morgan, defending a Negro charged with murder in 1963, filed a motion to quash the indictment in which he outlined his client's prospects. He wrote of the man's being arrested by white policemen, carried off in a segregated paddy wagon driven by a white man, and locked up in a segregated jail staffed solely by whites. He was to be brought to trial in a courthouse inhabited by whites, in a segregated courtroom run by white officials, before a jury that almost certainly would be solidly white. If he receives the death penalty, Mr. Morgan wrote, he will then be given a last meal by his white guards, visited by a white chaplain, shaved by a white barber, and taken by white guards to a yellow electric chair in Kilby Prison, the chair being the only facility in Alabama justice which is and has always been desegregated. A button, a switch will be pressed or pushed by a white man before white witnesses, and the condemned will die. Being in indigent circumstances, he will thereafter be buried in a potter's grave in a racially segregated cemetery provided by the state of Alabama. The segregated character that pervades Southern justice runs all the way through the judicial system, extending from the lowest municipal courts all the way up to the federal bench. The Southern Regional Council report on justice states that the 28 court clerks and the 109 jury commissioners attached to the federal courts of the 11 states of the old Confederacy are all solidly white and appointed by the 65 white district judges. Through these appointments, the judges build higher the walls of segregated justice. It is obvious then that what is needed is a reforming of the racist legal system of the South in such a way as to effectuate substantive justice within the procedural framework of the instrumentalities of law and order.
We're listening back to excerpts from a speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965. In addition to his comments on the justice system, Dr. King also reaffirmed his belief in the power of nonviolent action in the face of injustice.
Let me proclaim here and now that I am still convinced that the philosophy and practice of nonviolence affords a more excellent way to improve the inadequacies existing in the American social system. The method of nonviolent resistance is effective in that it has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience. It also makes it possible for the individual to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the most persistent debates of the centuries has been over the question of ends and means. There have always been those from Machiavelli on down who have argued that the end justifies the means. But nonviolence at its best breaks with any method which contends that the end justifies the means. In a real sense, the means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And so in the long run, destructive means cannot bring about constructive ends because the end is pre-existent in the means. Nonviolent resistance also provides a creative force through which men can channelize their discontent. It does not require that they abandon their discontent. This discontent is sound and healthy. Nonviolence saves it from degenerating into morbid bitterness and hatred. Hate is always tragic. It is as injurious to the hater as it is to the hated. It distorts the personality and scars the soul. Psychiatrists are telling us now that many of the inner conflicts and many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious are rooted in hate. And so they are now saying, love or perish. And this is the beauty of nonviolence. It says that you can struggle without hating. You can fight without violence. And it is my great hope that as the Negro plunges deeper into the quest for freedom, we will plunge even deeper into the philosophy of nonviolence. As a race, we must work passionately and unrelentingly for first-class citizenship, but we must never use second-class methods to gain it. We must never succumb to the temptation of using violence in the struggle, for if this happens, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness. And our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. I feel that this way of nonviolence is vital because it is the only way to reestablish the broken community. It is a method which seeks to implement the just law by appealing to the conscience of the great decent majority who, through blindness, fear, pride, or irrationality, have allowed their consciences to sleep. The nonviolent resistors can summarize their message in the following simple terms. We can take direct action against injustice without waiting for other agencies to act. We will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully, openly, and cheerfully because our aim is to persuade. We adopt the means of nonviolence because our end is a community at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our words, but if our words fail, we will try to persuade with our acts. We will always be willing to talk and seek fair compromise, but we are ready to suffer when necessary and even risk our lives to become witnesses to the truth as we see it. This approach to the problem is not without successful precedent. We have the magnificent example of Mohandas K. Gandhi, who challenged the might of the British Empire and won independence for his people by using only the methods of truth, non-injury, courage, and soul force. Today we have the noble example of thousands of Negro and white persons of goodwill who have nonviolently challenged the principalities of segregation. Their courageous and disciplined activities have come as a refreshing oasis in a desert sweltering with the heat of injustice. And they have taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. One day, all of America will be proud of that achievement. To outline the problem is to chart the course of the Negro freedom movement for the future. We have come to the day when a piece of freedom is not enough for us as human beings, nor for the nation of which we are part. We have been given pieces, but unlike bread, a slice of which does diminish hunger, a piece of liberty no longer suffices. Freedom is like life. You cannot be given life in installments. You cannot be given breath but not body, nor heart but no blood vessels. Freedom is one thing. It is indivisible. You have it all or you are not free. Our goal is freedom. I believe we will win it because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America.
Coming up, we hear more from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at UW-Madison in November 1965. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing a look back at the speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965. In this segment, he suggests that being maladjusted to injustice is a condition to embrace.
There are certain technical words within every academic discipline that soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical nomenclature. And modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. Certainly, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I say to you this afternoon, my friends, that there are some things in our nation and in our world to which I'm proud to be maladjusted, to which I call upon all people of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I must honestly say that I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence. For in a day when Sputniks and explorers and Geminis are dashing through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. And the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to a negotiated settlement of the conflict in Vietnam, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat will be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. And so it may well be that our world is in dire need of a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment, men and women who will be as maladjusted as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." As maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, could scratch across the pages of history words lifted to cosmic proportions. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." And through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. And so we go into the future with the faith that this problem can be solved if we work at it hard enough, in spite of the difficulties ahead, in spite of the problems that we still face. I believe if we become involved participants rather than silent onlookers, we can bring into being that brighter day. And this is why I still have faith in the future. And I still have faith that we will solve this problem. I have that faith because somehow the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We will solve it because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We will solve it because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed earth will rise again. We will solve it because that is something in the very structure of the cosmos which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. And yet that scaffold sways the future. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, I'm convinced that we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up that glad day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Those were excerpts from a speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965 to a crowd of 3,000 people. You can find audio of the speech in its entirety at wpr.org/centraltime. Thanks to the UW-Madison Archives for providing us with the audio. We'll leave you with one more thought from Dr. King. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
If this problem is to be solved north and south, in every hamlet and village of our nation, all people of goodwill must develop a sort of divine discontent. It will not be solved by individuals standing idly by the wayside, but by individuals becoming involved in the struggle for freedom and human dignity.
Stand-up has a special place in the American comedic tradition, but the craft hasn't always been the most prestigious one, but that's changing. It seems like comedians have ascended to a new level of popularity. They have massive social media followings, Netflix specials, and they even perform at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Here's a clip of comedian Hasan Minhaj telling jokes at the dinner. He stood behind the podium the president traditionally would have been behind.
I get it. We gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke.
Joining us now to talk more about the comedy boom is Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hi, good to have you with us. Do you think it's fair to say that we're living in a golden age of comedy?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. But for me, maybe it's a comedic instinct that makes me a little paranoid. I think, you know, after every golden age, when things are, after anything going too well, there's going to be a crash to the boom, if that makes any sense. So I'm very excited, but also a little fearful.
Kind of looking, worried that you're looking over the precipice, maybe.
Exactly.
So looking back at the history of comedy in America, are there other times in American history that we've seen comedy booms like this?
Definitely in the 80s, which was what you might call the comedy club boom. Comedy was on the rise, and that, of course, crashed. And I think now, because of social media and podcasting and all these new avenues for getting connecting with people and viewing entertainment, there is, you know, naturally, you know, comedy is important. And then with the political climate right now, it's almost like comedy is more relevant. Like we're seeking these people to make some sense of it all. And in some ways, comedians are held more accountable than politicians now. And I think all of this is sort of happening all at once. And that's where we're at now.
Going back to that comedy club boom and then bust, as you said, what was it about that particular, I don't know if type of comedy or type of presenting comedy, that it wasn't sustainable, that there was a bust at the end?
I don't know if you can blame it on the type of comedy. I think it was just something where, you know, a lot of comedy clubs were opening up at that point. And, you know, when things become too accessible, I think it becomes common to people and it becomes something that isn't as exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think all of that came into play. And, you know, now I think in hindsight, you look at the past of anything, you can kind of turn things into a caricature. And so, you know, there definitely is this idea of the sort of hack 80s comic. And maybe a little bit of that was at play. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to tell, to be honest.
So looking back at the 90s, a lot of those comics who were making names for themselves on that comedy club circuit and were out doing shows, TV network executives were really eager to throw sitcom deals their way. I'm thinking of Jerry Seinfeld, Roseanne Barr, Tim Allen, even going back to the 80s and Bill Cosby. What strikes you as different about this age of comedy?
I think there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that people have the opportunity to work on. I mean, I cannot even count the number of comedy programs that exist right now, be it late night television, be it comedy shows on things like Netflix and Hulu. I mean, I don't think every comic right now even wants a sitcom deal. I think there are so many different ways that you can even present your stand-up to an audience. It doesn't have to be you at a microphone. It can be you without a microphone. It can be, you know, PowerPoint heavy. It can be almost like a TED talk. And there's no such thing as just, you know, going on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and getting a sitcom deal right after. I think, you know, sometimes, you know, I think you do a late night set and you maybe get 50 followers on Twitter afterwards, and a few more people know your name, and you get to get a little bit closer to getting, you know, getting your name out there. It's not as cut as dry as it used to be, but the plus side is that there's so much more opportunity, and it might not be a sitcom on one of the major networks, but you could get a really cool web series out there. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, kind of just as important and just as valuable.
We're talking with Tim Barnes right now. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. And we're talking about the current boom in comedy. And would you say that stand-up comedy, that being in front of a live audience and having that really pretty intimate interaction with them, is it gaining more respect as a performing art?
I think so. I think audiences value a live experience more than ever. And I think about this even with the number of comedy specials that are coming out now. Like, there was a time where a comedy special meant it came out in a movie theater and you were still with an audience of strangers watching the special. I think about the classic, you know, Richard Pryor specials, Live on the Sunset Strip. Even when the Kings of Comedy came out, that was an event. You went to the movie theater to try to get the closest thing to the experience of seeing these comedians live on stage. And now when I watch stand-up, I'm usually alone in my room, maybe have my girlfriend with me, maybe, you know, like one other person. And I don't know if it's because I'm a comedian and I'm jaded, but I'm not, you know, I'm just kind of analyzing it. I'm not laughing. I'm not getting that sort of social feedback. And I think because stand-up is so much about this sort of social feedback, you know, some jokes can be something that you won't laugh at alone, but something about hearing a joke in front of an audience makes you realize, like, oh, there is something I didn't notice about that. Someone can tell a joke that I wouldn't laugh at alone, but all of a sudden I'm at a show and I realize that a lot of women in the audience are laughing at this joke because this means something. And mm-hmm. It's sort of an eye-opening experience. And I think all of that kind of stuff is so important to everybody right now.
And Tim, let's flip it around because you are a performing stand-up comic. What is it about that energy, that attention, that connection with the audience that hooks you as a comic?
Oh, me as a comic? Oh my God. Before I ever did stand-up, every public speaking experience I had was a disaster. Like, I have very vivid memories of doing, you know, reports in front of the classroom, things where you had to, you know, do stuff in front of all the other parents, and I'd just be crying. I was stuttering, I was crying, and there's something about getting this opportunity to make a point and getting a specific reaction from it. I consider myself to be a pretty quiet person, more of a watcher, someone who, in most conversations, I don't get to get my point through for some odd reason. And stand-up has been that one opportunity for me to do that. And I really do think that is the center of why I get joy out of it. I don't know if that's every comedian, but that's me.
But you say you're more of a watcher. Isn't that really key to being a good comic? Don't you have to be able to pull out those observations? I mean, that's what usually gets people laughing, whether self-consciously or with the realization, like, oh my gosh, I never put that together, or I never, you know, pulled that out of this experience that we've all had.
Oh, definitely. That's definitely an important part of it. And, you know, I don't know if you know too many quiet people, if you're a quiet person yourself, but quiet people have sort of a secret language. And I think
I am not fluent in that secret language. What is it?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. It's just something where, you know, I can meet another quiet person and just give a certain kind of eye contact and just we'll be laughing at each other because we're seeing this thing. We're not experiencing it the way most people are. And I think it might be a cliche that, you know, a lot of people say stand-ups are introverts, but it's very interesting when you get stand-up comics to talk to each other because we're kind of skipping parts of conversations that normal people have. Like, we're just trying to get to the punchline. We're not trying to have this sort of fluffy small talk. We're trying to, like, it's all sort of set up punchline. And it's, I think it's because we're a little annoyed by the inconvenience that a lot of people have to go through, the sort of procedure of conversation and just doing normal things that we have to do as human beings.
We're talking with Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True. It features interviews with various comedians. We're looking at the stand-up comedy boom in recent years and how the art has a renewed level of popularity. And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're living in a golden age of comedy? Who are your favorite comedians from the past or present? And how do you think comedy has changed? Tell us how comedy has influenced you and the person you are today. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Tim Barnes. He's a stand-up comic and host of the podcast It's All True, which features interviews with various comedians. We're looking at the recent boom in comedy, especially in stand-up. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're living in a new golden age of comedy? And do you think comedy is more or less influential today than it used to be? If you're a comedian, we'd love to hear about your comedy and where you get your inspiration. And do you find that comedy has become more diverse? And has that affected your interest in it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And do you think that comedy has gotten more diverse, Tim? Are we looking at a much wider range of people and experiences that are being brought to comedy?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I feel like I'm probably an example of that. And I know you played that Hasan Minhaj clip earlier. I mean, that's another example. And for me personally, before I started doing stand-up, it took part of why we are in this quote-unquote golden age right now for me to feel like, okay, I think I can do this. Because when Conan moved from NBC to TBS, And this is just part of this new landscape of so many late night television shows. I feel like one great thing about that is that he got to highlight so many stand-up comics on his TBS late night show than he ever did on NBC, and probably highlights more stand-up comics than any other late night show right now. And some of the performers that he had on there are like part of this new wave. People like Pete Holmes, people like TJ Miller, people like Ron Funches. And when Ron Funches went on Conan, that was an eye-opening experience for me, because that was one of the first times that I really saw a black person on stage who was so very weird and so very charming at the same time. And, you know, wasn't wearing a suit, you know, wasn't the sort of cool, collected comedian like Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle. And that's part of this new world of comedy right now. You can express yourself comedically in ways that aren't as pigeonholed as they were before. You know, I don't feel the need to go to chocolate sundaes at a comedy club. Although I do wish some comedy clubs had Wonder Bread Wednesdays. I think that would be wonderful.
Well, you mentioned Ron Funches, and we actually have a clip, so let's give a listen to that.
I left Chicago because there's a lot of gangs and violence. I did not know the Northwest also had gangs. They are not scary or effective. But they try so hard. I even ran into a gang on the Oregon coast, of all places. And I don't like to be racist, but it was a gang of blackbirds. A real murderer's row.
That, again, was Ron Funches, who you said, Tim, was influential for you. Is the fact that comedy is getting more diverse kind of giving everyone, whether they're male, female, white, black, anything, kind of more room to be themselves?
Yes. Short answer, yes. And I think, you know, there's sort of two sides to this coin when it comes to, you know, is social media a hindrance or is it a crutch for new comedians? I think, you know, social media in a lot of ways, having a Twitter account and testing out jokes and seeing who interacts with it is great for me and for a lot of people to really get their voice out there. And sort of like on that note, you know, I started doing stand-up 5 or 6 years ago, and through social media, I became sort of, you know, acquaintances with Ron Funches, and I even got to interview him on my podcast. And social media, I think, is an opportunity for a lot of people from diverse backgrounds to get their voice out there. You can get, you know, popular, you can become noticed, you can get asked to write for a television show because of it. I think, you know, this new way of communication has just been a great thing.
And we mentioned earlier that Netflix and other ways of delivering content is really picking up on the popularity of comedians, and that, you know, it used to be maybe a special or two a year came out that featured stand-up comedy, and now it's, you know, on a weekly basis, there's something new to watch, new comics to be introduced to. Here's a clip of a promo of Hannibal Buress's Netflix special.
The weirdest thing about getting a death threat from a male bodybuilder / stripper on Facebook is when you click on his profile and see that you have one mutual friend.
That was Hannibal Buress. So what does it mean for comics, you know, people who are considering comedy as something they want to, you know, spend their time on and perform? What does it mean to see so many comics getting what used to be the big break that was maybe limited to very few people?
I think it changes the goal setting. It's harder to become, you know, it makes it more difficult in some ways to become, you know, some people want to be the next Chris Rock. You know, there's probably 5 Chris Rocks right now. I saw an article, I think it was on Splitsider a couple months ago. I might be saying it wrong, but it was something like the best stand-up specials of May. something like that. And I thought, that's so wonderful, but also so frightening.
Mm-hmm. Next, there'll be the best stand-up specials of Tuesday.
Yeah, of May. There's so many stand-up specials out there. So, like, for new comics, it's great because you can, like, really just watch professionals and take notes and, you know, think about what you like and what you don't like about this. And every stand-up comic has imagined their comedy special, and this just makes that, you know, easier for you to sort of, you know, get accumulated to all this and figure out what you want to do. But again, I don't know if it's because I'm a comedian, but I don't know who's watching these, mm-hmm. these, because I watch some of them, some of the bigger ones, but it's harder because it's just so much easier for me to go to a show that a friend is doing than to watch a special. And I'm curious, you know, as to, I think culturally, this is something that we're going to be writing about for a while, about why we're seeking comedy so much. In general, comedy connects the dots, and it's so much harder for us to connect the dots with all of the news we're getting day to day. And hopefully the comedy that's being produced is a helpful distraction. Hopefully it's a distraction that in some subversive way educates and informs people. And, you know, we're getting some solid, something truly nourishing from this new golden age of comedy.
So comedy can be a distraction and a nourishment, but it can also be kind of therapy, can't it? And comedy and politics are so closely intertwined. We're in a really polarized political climate right now. Who do you think is really capitalizing as comedians on the politics of today?
I mean, definitely people like John Oliver, Trevor Noah, all of the politically, you know, aligned comedy programs. I think, you know, it's also funny to see how some people create a marketing strategy around it. It's like, I'd be curious to see what, you know, Bill Maher's angle would be if Hillary Clinton were president, you know? And I think, you know, Donald Trump has become a bit of a crutch, perhaps, mm-hmm. to comedy. Like, and you can almost predict the Donald Trump joke that's coming up oftentimes. But I think that's just where we're at right now. And I hope that in a couple months we'll be able to dive a little bit deeper, we'll get over our shock, and really focus on some substantive stuff. And trust me, there is comedy there as well. There's comedy in the cracks that we aren't focusing on.
And you talked earlier, Tim, about after every boom, not just in comedy, but other things, it seems like there are busts coming not far behind. What do you think could happen that would create a bust for this current comedy boom?
That's a tough one.
Is it maybe the saturation that you were kind of hinting at?
It is the saturation. And I think, you know, what I've laid out here throughout this entire conversation is my not being able to understand why certain people are seeking out comedy so much. And again, that's probably just because comedy has become a sort of second nature to me. Mm-hmm. But definitely I see, you know, this oversaturation as being, it's going to have a backlash, and maybe I should study drama at some point.
Well, Tim, this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Tim Barnes is a stand-up comic, podcast producer, and host of It's All True. It's a podcast that features interviews with various comedians. He joined us to talk about the comedy boom, especially the stand-up comedy boom, and how the industry has changed. And we want to know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page. What comedy is really appealing to you right now? What makes for good comedy in your mind? And have you ever done stand-up? Again, share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.